From New York Public Radio, this is On the Media. On the Media is produced by WNYC and heard across America on NPR stations. This podcast is made possible by WNYC and its listeners. Support your local public radio station. Visit onthemedia.org to find where On the Media is playing near you. And please help support this free service by becoming a member of WNYC at WNYC.org. WNYC On Demand is supported by Open from American Express, presenting the interactive webcast event, Making a Name for Yourself. Kate and Andy Spade and Bobby Brown discuss their leap from business to brand, created by Open from American Express. Registration at openforumonline.com.
From WNYC in New York, this is NPR's On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Some believe our military and intelligence personnel involved in capturing and questioning terrorists could now be at risk of prosecution under the War Crimes Act simply for doing their jobs in a thorough and professional way. This is unacceptable.
On Wednesday, President Bush for the first time acknowledged the presence of secret CIA detention facilities, and he discussed in detail how the administration has been trying to effectively but legally interrogate terror suspects. The torturing of suspects by the U.S. military was first reported in the New York Times during the U.S. invasion of Afghanistan, and we learned after the revelations about Abu Ghraib that the White House had crafted a new, narrower definition of torture, specifically that a practice can be called torture only when it, quote, rises to the level of death, organ failure, or the permanent impairment of a significant body function. A few reporters have done much to uncover the realities of U.S. practice, but Eric Umansky, who has written a history of post-9/11 torture reporting for the Columbia Journalism Review, gives low marks to the media overall. Eric, welcome back to the show.
Good to be here.
Your piece was very indicting about the journalism on the torture story, including a whole laundry list of familiar-sounding lapses, failure to connect the dots, underplaying of major developments, he said, she said reporting that failed to challenge demonstrably wrong assertions by the Bush administration. In fact, it was also familiar that I wonder why you devoted so many months to the anatomy of this particular issue.
I happen to think it's a very important story. I just don't think there's been an in-depth look at it, in particular given the fact that I think the conventional wisdom, and I think it's partially true, that it's reporters who deserve much of or even most of the credit for helping uncover the torture scandal.
In fact, you lavishly praise the work of several reporters, notably Carlotta Gall of the New York Times and Dana Priest and Barton Gellman of the Washington Post. You assign more blame for the media's half-hearted coverage to editors than you do to reporters. Why do you think they were gun-shy?
I think that there are various reasons. I think that there can sometimes be, and this is not just with torture, a certain deference to authority. To be the kind of first to go out there is, I think, a scary place to be. And then in particular, you have this sort of post-9/11 issue when it comes to torture of you're dealing with these elemental issues of people being afraid for their safety. So to push the issue of torture when it very well might involve torture of really bad men, it feels, I think, a little bit like you're putting yourself out on a ledge there.
Carlotta Gall of the Times found evidence of death by torture in Afghanistan back in 2002, but it took 2 years in the Abu Ghraib scandal in Iraq to generate any major coverage and any widespread moral outrage. But then after the military paraded a few half-wits before courts-martial and, you know, publicly ripped off their single stripes, the story seemed to disappear. Mm-hmm. What happened?
Torture in the spring of 2004, when the Abu Ghraib scandal broke and when those photos were published, became a kind of big story. You had scoop after scoop. And then the Bush administration, working with the Republican Congress, I think actually did a very effective job, frankly, of shutting down the new avenues for possible stories. Usually, or in previous years, you'd have congressional hearings. And they would go on for some period of time, and newspapers and TV could then peg stories off of that. But you don't have that. Usually you would have an independent investigation that would air things, and then stories could be pegged off that. You don't have that here again. I still think that reporters have an enormous amount of responsibility. I still think that they can push the story. It's difficult. It creates a different terrain. That's the reality.
what was left after the Abu Ghraib courts martial that we've seen was the personification of the bad apples theory that the president and Secretary of Defense Rumsfeld put forward, completely deflecting responsibility from the top, where finally, lo and behold, on Wednesday, the president made clear these directives were emanating.
Mm-hmm.
Did the press get suckered into buying the bad apple theory, or worse yet, not buy it and fail to discredit it?
I think that there was a relatively large failure to discredit it. The focus on these individuals, Lindy England and others from Abu Ghraib, had a real distorting effect. And in fact, I would argue a very misleading one. I mean, if you look deep enough in the papers, there were certainly efforts, and I think successful ones, to discredit that line and to show that abusive interrogation had, in fact, been policy.
You mentioned the word abusive, and as separate from torture, I guess that's one of the problems here, the very definition of torture, which you observe in your piece, the government was viewing in a very narrow way without the press quite noticing.
Because torture is illegal, in fact, under U.S. law. What the Bush administration did was to redefine torture to say it only is torture in these sort of exceedingly narrow definition. And reporters didn't particularly pick up on that. And you see it in all sorts of circumstances, particularly, I would suggest, in political coverage, where you would have these sort of straight reporting about what Condoleezza Rice was saying or what the president was saying and just sort of repeating that we don't torture.
Finally, Eric, on Wednesday, the president unveiled a bill that would liberalize the use of, well, he called them tough, but torture-like techniques in interrogations.
Mm-hmm.
And to you, the coverage of that proposed legislation mirrors the coverage of torture over the past 4.5 years.
Yeah, I mean, what you had was the president talking tough, talking about the tactics that have been used in a kind of euphemistic way. And the papers decide to headline what is, I think, an important aspect of it, and that is the fact that prisoners who were once at the secret CIA prisons are now being transferred to Guantanamo Bay. But very few papers decided to give prominent coverage to the other aspects of the president's push in this introduction of his bill, and that involves allowing evidence gained through abusive techniques, allowing the CIA to, in fact, use abusive methods, and indemnifying CIA interrogators and administration officials from prosecution under the War Crimes Act. That's all in this bill that the president just previewed. And unfortunately, only the LA Times saw fit to put that on page one.
Okay, Eric, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Eric Umansky is currently a Gordon Gray Fellow at the Columbia School of Journalism. His article, Failures of Imagination, American Journalists and the Coverage of American Torture, is in the September-October issue of the Columbia Journalism Review.
On the eve of the fifth anniversary of September 11th, 2001, we've heard references in every medium to the events of that day, right down to a new Al-Qaeda tape featuring the 9/11 hijackers. CNN is even offering a complete replay of that day's programming online. But though many note that it's been 5 years since 9/11, it may be more accurate to say that actually it's been 5 years of 9/11. That is, of the ensuing wars, bitterly divisive politics, and widely fluctuating appraisals of the press. We spoke to then-CNN anchor Aaron Brown on the first anniversary of 9/11, and he called it a defining moment for his generation of reporters.
We had waited a long time, I think, for that moment. Our generation had been defined by O.J. and Princess Diana, and we proved that we were very much prepared to handle the biggest story of our lives. I'm incredibly proud of my business on 9/11 and in the days and weeks and mostly the months afterwards.
But how about the years afterwards? I asked this week if he still felt the same.
I didn't think that the program did a terrible job on the build-up to the war, but I'd kind of like that one again a little bit. I would absolutely have liked to, and I said this whenever we talked last, I think the issues surrounding the Patriot Act are important. I'm not one of those people that thinks it's all terrible, or frankly, I'm not one of those people who thinks it's all good. What I am is one of those people who thinks that you can't know if it's all terrible and all good unless you really look at it. I'd like that again. I'd like to lay it out. Here's what it is. Here's exactly what it allows. Here's what government can do today without a warrant. Here's what it can do tomorrow.
And when you talk about the run-up to war, you're basically talking about a closer examination of the evidence and the pretext for going to war presented by the White House?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I actually think the mistakes that I made there had more to do with how I played stories. It's not that people who were skeptical of whether Iraq had weapons of mass destruction got an airing, because in fact they did. I'm not sure it was presented as clearly as I wish it had been.
And why do you think that is?
Oh, you know, I don't know, because I'm not as good as I wish I was. The one thing I don't think is true is the thing that people think is true, which is that we were cowed or afraid. I do think that we, because broadcast tends to do this, we were chasing New York Times stories a lot. But we were also chasing the inspectors and listening to the inspectors. I'm just not convinced that I played that balance. Not we, not CNN, not the media, that Aaron played that balance as well as he should have.
Is there a big lesson here for journalists in the way these past 5 years have been covered?
I'm certain there's not a lesson, that there are lots of lessons. The one that, you know, sort of being a bit outside it now and looking in, which is a kind of interesting perspective, is that, you know, every day those of us who think of ourselves as reporters need to wake up and almost literally look in the mirror and remind ourselves what it is that a democratic society requires of its press. This isn't a popularity contest. We are there to do serious work, keep governments honest, keep entities honest. And just because a terrible thing has happened, you don't get to walk away from it. You need to keep pushing. But reporters can't separate themselves from their life experiences. And I think that's what happened, is that we a little bit lost sight of the basic function because we were hurt also. Our country was also attacked. And I know that that affected coverage. And it's not to our credit that it did. It just did. I think people get this. I think most of us know. Most of us would like a do-over, in truth, on this. And perhaps if it were to play out again, we would handle it differently. But, you know, that's not how life works. You don't get a do-over.
Aaron, thank you very much.
Always good to talk to you.
Aaron Brown was CNN's news anchor in 2001. This is On the Media from NPR. This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. We've been hearing about convergence, it seems, forever. It was inevitable that all of our various digital gizmos would be reduced to one magic box that handles our TV, our email, our video games, our spreadsheets, and maybe our thermostat. Instead, we seem to be accumulating more and more digital boxes stacked up all over the house. But never mind, says MIT professor Henry Jenkins, convergence has still arrived. Citizens have embraced technology, especially the internet, not just to consume media, but in some cases to control it. In his book titled Convergence Culture, Where the Old and New Media Collide, He says the real convergence with technology is, quote, within the brains of individual consumers and through their social interactions with others.
Yeah, so what we're talking about is what I call participatory culture. It can mean, for example, in the case of reality television, Survivor fans tracking down information around the planet to find out what really happened on that island, using satellites to find the actual location, tapping the internet to track down the identities of the contestants before they're announced. In other cases, it may be creating. They talk about Star Wars fans making digital cinema. And increasingly, it can also be an activism, fighting back against the networks to keep your favorite show on the air.
Now, there's the convergence culture as it occurs organically. And then there's convergence as it's been expropriated by corporate America. My boss, Scott Donatan, at Ad Age, coined the term Madison and Vine. Tell me about that crossroads.
The idea is that fans have enormous stake in popular culture. And if the advertising industry can harness that stake and direct it toward brands and products, they create a much more intense relationship to that as well. And maybe the classic example of that is something like Coca-Cola's relationship to American Idol. The Coke is embedded at every level, from the red room where the contestants wait to the Coke cups in front of the judges. Now, this brand community thing becomes a double-edged sword because the communities around the brand become so invested in the product that they will also police the behavior of the companies. In the case of American Idol, there was such outrage over the voting mechanism, which AT&T had branded, that it has led to a backlash against AT&T as a brand, and then that spills over to some degree to Coke and Ford, who were part of the same sponsorship arrangement for a show that where the sponsors are really part of the entertainment.
We've seen how ordinary people using the internet can participate in a culture which they had merely been witnesses to. But what happens on the other end? Do they end up actually altering the nature of the very entertainment programming that they're involved in as fans?
There's always a kind of tug of war going on. I mean, a classic example of this might be the case this summer of Snakes on a Plane. Here's a case where fans discovered a property early in its run. They began to promote their particular version of what that film should be like. And in this case, the production company got behind that, reshot scenes, added dialogue, changed their advertising campaign, and publicized their responsiveness to the fan community. Now, there's a great deal of debate now about what the outcome of that was. Did fan activity hurt or help the release of Snakes on the Plane? My own view is it helped it. It probably created more of a phenomenon, got more publicity than they paid for, increased awareness, and the long-term impact of that is going to be felt as we look at, say, how does it affect DVD sales? How does it affect global sales? Does it have an afterlife on college campuses? So the negotiation between fan and producer in that point created value. It may just be value that unfolds itself over a longer period of time than I think the mentality which says you pump the ads into the air and then the film opens big and you make most of your money to the opening weekend. I think we're not sure what the payoff is going to be from a production company point of view of mobilizing fans.
Let's talk about Star Wars for a moment, or Harry Potter, either one. Both of these have generated fans so devoted that they actually create sometimes full-length versions based on the original story. Movie studios and publishers react in various ways to this degree of fandom. I guess it cuts both ways for them. Tell me, what's the status quo and where do you think the world is headed?
We'll take the case of Harry Potter, which is a phenomenon where there literally are millions of stories out there and probably thousands of full-length novels that people have written, including stories written by 13, 14-year-olds who are fans of that particular work. J.K. Rowling, early in, the creator of Harry Potter, really encouraged it. She was excited that the books were not only encouraging kids to read, but also to write. The studios had more ambiguous feelings, and they sent out cease and desist letters that caught up in their net a large number of young people from around the world. The young people, in turn, organized a children's campaign to protect their right to participate, and Warner Brothers, in its wisdom, backed down. It reappraised its attitude toward fans. It tried to actively solicit their participation, find new ways to work with them. If you think about the world we live in, it's one where no one is certain what the rules are, but I think it's going to be almost impossible to shut down this grassroots activity, and it can indeed generate a fair amount of actual value to the production company if they understand how to interact with it in a constructive way.
All right, Henry. Well, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Henry Jenkins is the author of, most recently, Convergence Culture, Where Old and New Media Collide. We spoke about TV. Another realm where old and new media have been duking it out is the world of journalism. But is it possible that both have valuable, even crucial, lessons to learn from each other? NYU journalism professor Jay Rosen thinks so and is launching an experiment to test his theory. It's called newassignment.net, and it works like this. Editors for the website will each host blogs where ideas for new reporting projects are shaped with the help of reader input. Editors shepherd the brainstorming and dispatch participants to do preliminary reporting. If the story idea is popular, editors will solicit donations to fund more in-depth reporting, and if they're successful, will assign reporters to finish the job. That's the short version. Here to flesh it out is Professor Jay Rosen. Jay, welcome back to the show.
Thank you.
Tell me basically, you know, using some sort of hypothetical story, mm-hmm. how this all would work.
Well, a simple example would be, what are our schools actually doing with computers in sixth grade classrooms? NewAssignment.net tries to find out. What's the best way to find that out? Well, we could ask the schools, but probably a better way would be to ask actual parents and kids who are in those classrooms as well as lots of teachers. And if such an assignment caught enough imagination online from users, we might fashion it into a project and enlist volunteers and begin coming up with new knowledge about this subject, which we happen to know is of interest because lots of people told us.
What kind of money are we talking about? It's very expensive to mount a journalistic enterprise.
It is. If you have to send a reporter to Bangalore to find that factory and write about it so that you understand something going on at home, that costs money. So newassignment.net is actually going to try everything it can think of to try, which would include sponsorships and advertising and memberships and underwriting and all forms of donation, including click here and contribute.
I want to ask you about click here and contribute, because one of the recurring criticisms of the mainstream media is that the corporate ownership thereof and the presumption, therefore, that the reporters and editors in the process are somehow answerable to the man and that that informs their coverage. But I know you've given some thought to the he who pays the piper calls the tune problem. And doesn't it strike you that the pressures on a reporter to fulfill the expectations of the people who are sponsoring his or her story will make the influence of the man seem trivial?
That is definitely something we have to watch out for, and we're just going to have to look at that problem and figure out how it is solved. The first layer of protection is going to be an editor, which is somebody who's going to stand between donors and journalists in that most basic way. But the site will also have to have very tight controls and editorial standards. So I think that people might try and sort of influence the process somehow through their donations, but it's not going to be successful if we do this right.
One thing I've observed watching bloggers over the last few years is that they are, you know, as a body, aggressive and fearless and tireless. But what strikes me as being missing from many, many blogs is, you know, some measure of, if not objectivity, at least intellectual rigor in presenting a story.
Mm-hmm.
Is it your idea to make clear to participants that what we're talking about is journalism and not ideology?
Well, newassignment.net is definitely about producing journalism, yes. But it doesn't say that only ideology-free people can do that. And that certainly is going to be one of the things that separates it from the mainstream press. So maybe we'll have very fiercely point-of-view journalists doing assignments, and we'll learn how to include in them a right of reply, and we'll balance ourselves that way. Or we'll do the same problem from one perspective and then another. And see who wins. We have a lot of options available to us, and we're not going to be hemmed in by existing notions of what's professional or credible, because I think the whole challenge here is to figure out how you build trusted content online through interaction with the people who are going to trust it.
You're not going to be held to traditional concepts of what is credible? Isn't credibility the very heart, the blood, or the, I don't know, whatever, the core of journalism?
We're not going to try and go about building trust online in the same way that a mainstream news organization goes about it. We'll have other ways. For example, newassignment.net will probably practice a form of fact-checking that exceeds what you'd find on a daily newspaper. And we'll organize networks of people to do that. The internet is different in one very powerful respect, which is it doesn't only connect members of the audience up vertically to NPR and the White House, but it also connects them horizontally to each other. And what we need to figure out is how is this newfound ability for people to share information horizontally going to affect the vertical synthesizing of information that professional journalism has been totally dedicated to. In the end, if newassignment.net succeeds, and even where it fails, it's going to be good for major news organizations because the news media will be able to see what's in these methods.
Jay, thank you very much. Good luck with the project.
Okay, thanks, Bob.
Jay Rosen is a journalism professor at New York University. He blogs at pressthink.org. Meanwhile, Zay Frank, a former ad industry consultant and veteran blogger, is already doing for entertainment what Rosen wants to do for journalism. Zay says that his webcast, called The Show, draws more than 100,000 viewers a day, and he's pledged to keep producing it until next spring. What do people see there? Basically, 2 minutes of rapid-fire close-ups on Zay's unblinking face as he riffs on whatever happens to be on his mind. Sometimes it's the news, sometimes it's his health. Sometimes he throws out little challenges to his audience, who he refers to as the Fabulosos. Back in May, for instance, he invited people to grab a slice of bread and position themselves on opposite sides of the world, thereby creating an Earth sandwich.
The challenge will run 300 arbitrary units of time. It won't be easy, sports racers. That's why you've been provided with the If the Earth Were a Sandwich data visualization Find My Opposite tool. You can find it by clicking on the link below.
As has been the case with most of his audience participation gimmicks, the Earth sandwich did get results.
There were two serious attempts, but one that really nailed it, and that was between New Zealand and Spain. And two American travelers who were backpacking through Europe made a wonderful video, which you can watch on the site, of themselves being chased through cow pastures with a GPS locator and trying to find the exact spot to complete the Earth sandwich.
Chased by farmers, by cows, by whom?
Dogs. Chased by dogs hungry for bread.
That is citizen-generated content, if ever I heard of it.
One of the really interesting things about online media production is that you have a very tangible conversation that's going on with the audience. There's all sorts of activities that, you know, are constantly recycled into the show. They actually introduce the show now.
Good evening, sports racers. This is The Show, presented to you from Innsbruck, Austria.
Sports racers, we're in Ohio.
Good morning, sports racers. This is Zay Frank, your not friend.
You're not Zay Frank, I am. But you're my first not friend. I can't wait to...
Well, not my dog, sports racers. Gemüse euch, show.
You know, there's segments where I take their comments.
Something from the comments. Shrek writes, Zay, today is my first day of college and I don't have any friends. Any advice? Shrek, if you don't have close friends by the end of your first day at college, you should realize that there's probably something wrong with you. A good place to check in is...
One effort was I used wiki software to allow the users to come together as a community and write a show for me. And that was partly because I was frustrated with a lot of the comments that I was getting, telling me to do a variety of things differently.
Was this a means of sort of harnessing the collective genius of the crowd, or kind of like, well, if you're so smart, let's see if you can do better, or, you know, something in between?
You know, from my standpoint, one of the really interesting things that's happening is that people are starting to understand how to make media. There's very low-cost production tools. Unfortunately, they're not all that good at it. So in the development of the show, I try to create a very wide range of activities, which allows people to be very clear on how they contribute, some sort of a rule set, which tells them what they're supposed to be doing. A rule set that also lets people see how their particular contribution affected the whole of the project. And so that's everything from small little fun voting doodads to very, very high activity things like playing me in chess. I ask people to send me pictures of themselves being attacked by office supplies. which is, you know, its own little rule set. It had to be a picture and it had to be this large.
Yesterday I resigned from the chess game that I've been playing with the Fabulosos. But some people thought that I was resigning from the show. That's crazy. At some point I might take a day or two off, but I'm with you until March 17th of next year.
All right, so you're 6 months into this project. You're halfway through. What have you concluded?
What have I concluded? I would say there's this notion that this space is sort of a quasi-reality space, right? And that in a sort of different way than television, you actually, there's this sense that you and your audience are enmeshed somehow and that they know something about you and you sort of know something about them. And I guess one of the really surprising things is the degree to which that's true. You know, the kind of emotional investment that I have gotten from this and, you know, the degree to which a single comment in a huge comment field can pretty much ruin my day is really, really remarkable.
You've got 100,000 people a day streaming your production, which is, you know, let's say a bigger audience than Tucker Carlson has. And he makes a lot of money and he's pretty famous. To what extent have you been able to cash in on the success of your show? I mean, is this a money-making proposition?
You know, the amount of time and sort of personal resource that I spend on the show makes it very, very hard to call any sort of financial gain on my part cashing in. One of the interesting things now is getting involved in this conversation of what exactly is the business model. But it's not really about finding the business model that works. It's about, you know, a few really large key players starting to invest real money into this space, you know, deciding that there's value in this space. So in the meantime, you know, I have all this sort of requisite web money-making tactics in place. I sell T-shirts. I have text links. And, you know, probably the most unusual thing that I do is I work with Rever, which encodes a small click-through ad on the end of my video and gives me some of the money from that.
And are you making a living compared to what you were making when you were, you know, in the advertising business?
No. The answer to that question is no.
Zay, thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
Zay Frank's daily video blog can be viewed at his website, zefrank.com.
As I lay this bread on the ground, I know my job ain't done. But if the earth were a sandwich, we would all be one sandwich.
Coming up, we boldly go where lots and lots and lots of people have gone before.
This is On the Media from NPR.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and the Kresge Foundation, investing in nonprofits to help them catalyze growth, connect to stakeholders, and challenge greater support. On the web at kresge.org. The Wallace Foundation, supporting ideas, sharing solutions, expanding opportunities. On the web at wallacefoundation.org. And the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, committed to helping Americans lead healthier lives and get the care they need. On the web at rwjf.org. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone.
The top story tonight that everyone is talking about is the ABC docudrama about September 11th that is set
what
to air.
What is the controversy? whether the Clinton White House missed an opportunity to get Osama bin Laden. Well,
apparently close friends of the former president have written ABC demanding changes, and they might get them.
So when exactly does poetic license slide into political scandal? ABC's two-part, five-hour docudrama, The Path to 9/11, aims to portray our nation's leaders in the long run-up to a terrible day that everybody remembers and no one fully understands. And to make the show compelling, and many critics say it is, the producers have made skillful use of the standard toolbox of docudramatic technique, compressing time frames and crafting composite characters and inventing conversations, some of which reflect poorly on the Clinton White House.
I don't get it. Everybody in that room agrees that we're at war with this guy, but they flinch at the idea of whacking him. War is about killing the enemy and destroying his property. It's not about sitting around a conference room covering your own asses.
Just a bit of drama for a docudrama. But juxtapose fictionalized discussions about nabbing Osama with real footage of the Lewinsky scandal, and a viewer might think the president was fatally distracted. He says he wasn't. The 9/11 Commission report says he wasn't. A fictional flourish becomes a judgment on a presidency. The 9/11 Commission's GOP chairman, Thomas Kane, who served as paid consultant on the series, says it's, quote, reasonably accurate. Democrats, many of whom have only seen part one, may be screaming now, but he says the show will get just as much howls from Republicans. Scholastic, the global children's media company which had prepared classroom materials for the series, caught on just in time. Richard Robinson is Scholastic's president and CEO.
We simply, upon review of the teaching material, discovered that we didn't focus tightly enough on the difference between a docudrama and the documentary, the invented events, and so forth and so on.
On Friday, Scholastic replaced its original teaching materials with material that emphasized the controversy over what is real and what is not. Meanwhile, ABC, after distributing copies of the series, announced that it wasn't finished. It was still editing. So far, it's failed to find a single sponsor and may have to eat the $30 million cost. Maybe it's time to apply a 100-year rule to the making of docudramas. Wait a century or so before dramatizing an actual event, and it won't matter so much if you're wrong. But if you just can't wait, for the love of God, don't air it on an anniversary, because that's when people are most inclined to take it personally.
In this era of participatory media, we sometimes forget that there is one media franchise that has been shaped and elevated and kept alive almost entirely by its fans. And so, to mark the 40th anniversary of Star Trek, we've managed, through great effort, to secure a committed Trekkie to explain what's kept the franchise afloat. I'm sorry, Trekkie? I mean Trekker.
Okay, I can hear that tone in your voice. I'm used to it, because I admit it, I am and have ever been a Star Trek fan.
Get a life, will you, people? For crying out loud, it's just a TV show.
When William Shatner said that on Saturday Night Live, though to be fair, he didn't write it, it stung.
I think a lot of fans feel like they are not respected. They're almost ashamed to admit they're fans of Star Trek unless they hear two or three references to Star Trek in the conversation.
Not Barbara Adams. So moved was she by the series' optimistic, pluralistic vision of the future that when serving on the jury in the Whitewater trial 10 years ago, she wore the uniform of a Starfleet officer. If it helps to make people think a little more about what those ideals are, then I'll keep wearing this uniform, she said, and then was promptly dismissed for talking to the press. Those ideals were codified by Gene Roddenberry, a former flack with the LAPD, who cut his teeth writing Dragnet scripts on spec for Jack Webb. His Enterprise was staffed by a crack multiracial crew, and though that crew was prohibited by the Prime Directive from interfering in developing societies, as they hopped from planet to planet, Captain James T. Kirk found some way to stamp out race hatred, fascism, and religious extremism wherever he went. As Tim Cavanaugh observes in the current issue of Reason magazine, the world of Star Trek was not so much a utopia as a kind of galactic great society, which he says eerily predicted the era of total interventionism.
Star Trek prefigures neoconservatism,
because it's socially liberal. But anytime there's a whiff of totalitarianism or just something that Kirk doesn't like about a planet, he'll find a way to overthrow the government. And they'll leave at the end of the episode. It's like, okay, well, we got rid of, you know, the god that these people have been worshiping for 5,000 generations or something, and now they're on their own. You'll enjoy freedom.
Roddenberry allowed us to examine the convulsions of the 60s, like the Cold War, poverty, and hippies, at a distance, mostly through aliens, since he had decreed that there would be no serious conflicts among the crew. But occasionally controversy did creep onto the bridge, as when Kirk and his black female communications officer, Lieutenant Uhura, played by Nichelle Nichols, engaged in America's first interracial TV smooch. Despite network fears, it didn't spark much rage, perhaps because
there are mind-controlling aliens who make them do it, and, you know, they're sort of fighting it all the way, which, of course, just makes it even hotter.
I'm so frightened, Captain. I'm so very frightened. I wish I could stop trembling.
Try not to think of them.
Part of the Star Trek lore is that Nichelle Nichols, and this is a first-person claim by her, that she wanted to quit the show at some point in its run, and Martin Luther King personally appealed to her to keep doing the show because she was the only black woman on TV who wasn't playing a maid, and that's below the Voting Rights Act or Brown versus Board of Education or something in terms of achievement, but it was actually big stuff then. I mean, it was seemed controversial at the time.
And I would hear your voice from all parts of the ship.
But controversy didn't kill the show. After three seasons, the ratings did. And for almost two decades, as the ranks of fans swelled through reruns and conventions, they wrote their own episodes and lobbied the network. Henry Jenkins, the MIT professor who spoke earlier with Bob, says that much of that pressure came from an unexpected quarter.
I think if you go back and look at the original letter-writing campaign that kept the series on the air for that third season, which made it viable for a syndication package, the majority of the leaders of that campaign were women. And while the women were disappointed in the ways they were portrayed on Star Trek often, it kept alive this idea that women alongside men would be active participants in shaping the future.
So, finally, after a short-lived animated show and a handful of movies, a new live-action series was launched. And instead of boldly going where no man had gone before, the new crew was to
boldly go where no one has gone before.
We had three female cast members on Next Generation.
Executive producer Rick Berman.
One was Counselor Troy, one was the Doctor, and there was some discussion that here we had two women in caretaker roles, which seemed a little sexist. But Gene also created this character, Tasha Yar, who was the head of security on board the ship. And she was a tough broad and probably the sexiest of the three.
Berman was handpicked by Roddenberry to launch the second series, but he's been widely reviled by the fans for coming to the franchise as a newbie and for failing to fully commit to the founder's vision.
If I could sit and corral all the things that have been said over the years, especially on the internet, you could put me just a little bit this side of Himmler. Did I see the original series as sacrosanct and sacred? No. Did I do my very best to keep from contradicting anything that occurred in those episodes? Absolutely.
Star Trek The Next Generation also depicted a crew on a voyage of exploration, this time captained by the resolutely rational Jean-Luc Picard, a contrast to the impulsive Kirk. It lasted 7 years, bookended by episodes in which an omnipotent being called Q put humanity on trial.
You will now answer to the charge of being a grievously savage race.
Grievously savage could mean anything. I will answer only specific charges.
Are you certain you want a full disclosure of human ugliness? So be it, fool. Present the charges!
It's a squeaker, but guess who wins? In Star Trek, humanity always wins. The sole exception was series number 3, Deep Space Nine, mounted by Berman after Roddenberry's death. Set on a space station in a time of war, humans and aliens were forced to confront crime and corruption within the crew, and the humanity within all these species did not always win.
Will that be all, Commander?
I want you to know, I don't personally believe that you are responsible for this.
Really? Now, how can that be true? You don't know me. So don't tell me there isn't some doubt inside of you, some question about whether or not I murdered the man.
Some die-hard fans grumbled about the dark nature of Deep Space Nine, very un-Roddenberry, but that series also lasted 7 years. The fourth series, Star Trek Voyager, was set on a ship flung to the outer reaches of the galaxy. Its mission was simply to return home, and it also marked a return to the original vision. Only this time, the glass ceiling was broken. Rick Berman.
We wrestled a great deal with trying to find an actress who could play the captain on Voyager who at the same time could be feminine and tough.
We don't run.
Don't be foolish. Leave now and save yourselves.
Give me my people and we'll do just that.
They're mine.
And get ready for a fight. Red alert.
Did you have to grapple with the idea of femininity, or did you just leave that whole discussion off the table?
No, of course I had to grapple with it, and it was one of the hardest things, and it was in extreme evidence from the first moment.
Kate Mulgrew played Captain Catherine Janeway.
And I realized that what was at stake was their largest and most robust demographic, young men from the ages of 20 to 35. How was I going to transcend the fact that they could be potentially watching their mother?
In fact, they watched her for 7 years, even though the bodacious Borg 7 of 9 was added to the crew to boost ratings. But even she represented more than just sex appeal, because in Star Trek, humanity was always the real final frontier, so the best-loved characters were not human. The half-Vulcan Spock in the first series, the android Data in the second, Odo, the shapeshifter, in the third, and 7 of 9 in the fourth. They showed what it meant to be human by reacting against it, or more often, groping toward it. Here's Data on a date.
This is all part of a program?
Yes. One which I have just created for romantic relationships. I have written a subroutine specifically for you. I have devoted a considerable share of my internal resources to its development.
Data... that's the nicest thing anybody's ever said to me.
Later, Data gets an emotion chip, but ultimately rejects it. Spock would approve. He never understood Kirk's infatuation with humanity.
But, Captain, we both know that I am not human.
Spock, you want to know something? Everybody's human.
I find that remark insulting.
I love Spock. He's really awesome.
What's your name?
Emma.
How old are you?
15.
We found Emma at the Mohegan Sun Casino in Northern Connecticut checking out a display of Star Trek memorabilia soon to be auctioned by Christie's. Like thousands of others, Emma writes fan fiction, original stories based on the series, and she posts them on her blog, as do many of her friends.
Most of them write from the original series, Kirk and Spock. They either write Slash or just friendship.
What's Slash?
Slash is the game romance, and it's very popular all over the web. And I write some of it, but I prefer the friendship.
She says the fans she's met online hated the last series, called Enterprise, set in a time before the original series, and they're very riled up about the new movie, another prequel, which recasts Kirk and Spock as students at Starfleet Academy.
And people say they can't do this to our franchise, and they call it their franchise. I know it's definitely not our franchise, but I think we have a big part in it because without the fans, there would be no continuation. There would have been no The Next Generation or Deep Space Nine or Voyager.
Through the fans, Star Trek lives long and prospers in cyberspace, where they create and consume thousands of new stories and hundreds of videos, including new episodes. It's not what Trekkers solemnly regard as Star Trek canon. It's called fanon, a tapestry of new plots and backstories endlessly embroidered by fans. And for decades, they have boldly taken Star Trek where no network ever would, including, as Emma just said, Slash fiction, as in Kirk slash Spock, as in the love that dare not speak its name. MIT prof Henry Jenkins.
All of fan fiction is interested in exploring the emotional lives of characters.
Consider Spock's death scene in The Wrath of Khan, behind a wall of glass.
Kirk is on one side of the glass, Spock is on the other, and Spock comes closest to speaking the emotional truth of their relationship.
The needs of the many outweigh
the needs of the few.
Or the one. And always shall be your friend. If live long and prosper.
If we accept that the Spock and Spock are the most powerful friendship in the series, and that Spock or Kurt would sacrifice any female lover to save the other, then we understand what's at stake. That what Slash does, or Kirk Spock stories do, is remove that glass. Sex becomes the vehicle for exploring emotional intimacy between these two characters. So it's an enormously innovative and rich site of grassroots media.
I asked Kate Mulgrew what she thought of the Trekkers she'd met.
Whereas I may have looked once upon these people with a jaundiced eye, as the years passed, I began to understand that this was a very uncommon group of extremely intelligent people who had thrown their imaginations into the final frontier. So I find them very forward-thinking, very innovative, and by and large, extremely moral.
We grew up really loving Star Trek in the purest possible way.
Reason Magazine's Tim Cavanaugh.
We just loved it as kids. You get to high school, you get to college, suddenly you become this super ironist, and you realize how campy it is and over the top. And every joke about Captain Kirk getting it on with green women, or about crew members wearing red shirts and dying, or what Mr. Spock found in the toilet, they've all been made. To some degree, the show has outlived all of that stuff.
Which may be irrelevant to fans for whom the show may have actually outlived the show.
I don't think fans should worry about there not being a Star Trek series on. If it's not a good Star Trek series, if it's not showing us what we want to see in Star Trek, we don't have to have it there.
For instance, the most recent series called Enterprise was not embraced by erstwhile Whitewater juror Barbara Adams, and she's communications officer for her fan club called the Federation Alliance, which requires most of its members to do community service to make this world now a better place.
I think that we should work at that future that Gene showed us 40 years ago. The ideals can still survive within our minds and certainly within our communities as long as we work at it.
At some point, for fans like Adams, Star Trek shapeshifted from a franchise to a kind of creed, perhaps because Roddenberry made it seem almost plausible, because it made use of real science and referenced real history. Or maybe it's because his founding vision was bound up in the belief that ultimately it is our shortcomings, our passion, our restlessness that will save us. That as much as Vulcan logic and detachment are venerated in the Trek world, it's somehow better to be human.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Megan Ryan, Tony Field, Jamie York, and Mike Volo, and edited by Brooke. Dylan Keefe is our technical director, and Jennifer Munson, our engineer, our webmaster, is Amy Pearl.
Katya Rogers is our senior producer, and John Keefe, our executive producer. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. This is On the Media from WNYC. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
So be it, fool.
On the Media is supported by Live from Lincoln Center. On September 13th, Live from Lincoln Center broadcast the New York Philharmonic Opening Night Gala Concert, featuring music director Laura Mazel and guest soloists Emmanuel Ax and Yafim Bronfman. Check local PBS listings. Support for On the Media also comes from the Bydell Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, the John and Anna Maria Phillips Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.
Thanks for checking out this week's On the Media from WNYC, New York Public Radio. Support your local public radio station. Visit onthemedia.org to find where On the Media is playing near you. And please help support this free service by becoming a member of WNYC at wnyc.org. And thanks.
On Notes from America, we have conversations with people across the country about how we can truly become the nation that we claim to be. Each week, we talk about race, our politics, education, relationships, usually all of them, because everything's connected. And you, our listeners, are at the center of those conversations. I'm Kai Wright. Join me on Notes from America, wherever you get your podcasts.